You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. I have said it a million times that as a history buff, I never get enough. But every now and then, a book will come across my desk that I consider somewhat unusual in regards to history. This most recent one, A Worse Place Than Hell by educator and author John Madison, is a book that talks about the Civil War, but more specifically, not a particular battle, not necessarily a particular general. Certainly, President Lincoln gets mentioned, but very, very briefly. This is about individuals, some of which were household names, others had never even crossed my mind, names I had never even heard of. But throughout the book, these characters come to life. John's done a great job of bringing them to life and what they were exposed to, how their life changed as they were going through various episodes of the war. And I found it most interesting, most educational, and as I said, a nice alternative to reading mainstream history where they talk about battlefields and, as I said, generals and et cetera, et cetera. So with me this weekend is educator and author John Madison. John, nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Was it your intent from the outset? As I said, I mean, you could have, I suppose you could have written about a particular person. This does center around the Battle of Fredericksburg, but more importantly, it's bringing to life, a number of characters: Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., Louisa May Alcott. Many people probably have heard those names. Walt Whitman, certainly. Arthur Fuller, who I had never heard of before, and John Pelham, just to mention a few. But first of all, why those individuals?
Well, I was striving in a way, Al, for a kind of balance in various ways. So I didn't want to just tell a Union Army story. I wanted to have a Confederate perspective. I didn't just want to tell male stories. So, so Louisa May Alcott, whom I've written about before, fitted in very, very neatly. I think that you may know, and some of the listeners may know, that I'm principally a biographer. I usually write a book about one person or two people. And this time I was kind of trying to write history, I think. But even in the writing of history, I find myself getting tugged back over and over again into biography. I think what really kind of matters to me most is that kind of story of the individual that you're talking about. And sometimes they're famous, sometimes they're a little more obscure. But I think, when you're dealing with an event as massive as a battle, like the Battle of Fredericksburg, it can get to be, almost overwhelming unless you're able to pull out individual stories and individual points of view to bring, this, epic crisis back down to a human scale. So I started off as a biographer trying to write history, and maybe now I'm a historian who writes biographically. I don't know.
Well, as I said, in the context of the Civil War, which as most people would know, is to this day remains a defining moment in U.S. history. But more importantly, what I enjoyed so much about the book was the fact that people that didn't need to get involved in the war, in other words, some came from substantial means, others had basically nothing, but each took a road that changed the direction of their life forever. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Let's start with Oliver Wendell Holmes. People, that name resonates with a lot of people, but this gentleman certainly went through a lot of changes, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. He begins the war as a very recent Harvard graduate. When we think now about people who pursue military careers, you don't get a whole bunch of Ivy Leaguers anymore because the fulcrum of society has shifted. And what's remarkable about Holmes some of the other people I write about is that there really is, as you said, no reason why they absolutely positively have to get involved in this horrific 4-year-long bloodbath. But Holmes's regiment, the 20th Massachusetts, was so chock full of Harvard men that it was actually called the Harvard Regiment. It's fascinating to see this young man of privilege, of, you know, some social stature through his father, Oliver Sr., who's already a famous doctor and a famous poet, et cetera. It's interesting to see that that Holmes Jr. doesn't, you know, hide himself behind privilege. He doesn't hide himself behind his good fortune. In fact, he even tries to leave Harvard before graduation to join a regiment, but that then doesn't, kind of fizzles. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are people, all of them, who heed a higher call of duty. And for some of them, it's a call that they hear right after the bombardment of Fort Sumter that starts the war. For some of them, like Whitman, it takes a year and a half trying to figure out, well, what can I do in this war? What role can I play? How can I help the cause? And so we've got this, once again, kind of a neat balance between people who dash forward into the thing from the outset and others who are, you know, just baffled and flummoxed by the changing of events and not really sure what this holds for them. So there's this nice balance between, you know, patriotic fervor and a little bit of indecision.
John, as you said, the war brought these people to the forefront, changed their lives. You know, the impact that they had on others' lives certainly made changes as well. But had it not been for the war itself, first and foremost, and then secondly, their involvement, including, as I said, you know, the more recognizable names, the Wendell Holmeses, the Alcotts, the Walt Whitmans, would these people have been forgotten or relegated to obscurity?
Well, you know, I think that we would understand these lives very differently if the war had not taken place. And I do think that, it, you know, to take Louisa May Alcott's case, I think it's very likely that she would have been just a literary footnote if it had not been for the war. Because before the war, Alcott is struggling as a professional writer, kind of. She's writing what she calls blood and thunder tales for the popular press that bring in some money, but they don't really bring any fame or prestige. And then she goes to war, and she bases a book on her experiences as an Army nurse. It's a book called Hospital Sketches, which turns into her first literary success. It puts her on the map. But one of the most important things it does is it catches the attention of an editor named Thomas Niles, who remembers her 4 or 5 years later, gets in touch with her and says, "Hey, Miss Alcott, would you like to write a book for girls?" And that book for girls turns into Little Women, which is, you know, it's the oldest children's book in the American canon, you know, the oldest one that people still read. So it's foundational for American children's literature, and it takes, you know, this, you know, otherwise, you know, up to that point in her life, at least, obscure writer, and catapults her into you know, everlasting fame and recognition. She suffers for that. She becomes ill as a nurse in the war. She very nearly dies. Her health is permanently compromised. But you know, there's sort of this yin and yang. There's this light and dark to it. She surrenders her health to a large extent, but she gains a reputation, and America gains, you know, through her subsequent writings.
Yeah, it's right on. I mean, I got the same impression after reading the book that, you know, as you said, she would have been a writer, but nothing of any note. And the turn of events that the Civil War brought forth, you know, basically propelled her. Similar situation with John Pelham, again, a name that I had never heard of before, all of a sudden becomes an expert in munitions and use of cannons and becomes a quite an important person, especially to his brigade, especially to his comrades, and a fervent, you know, this guy was willing to, you know, to obviously lay down his life, but I mean, he made attempts that I think anybody else would have probably shunned from. Again, who was John Pelham before the Civil War?
Well, John Pelham before the Civil War is a kid from Alabama, and not from, you know, not from a big city in Alabama. He's kind of this, you know, backwoods boy whose, you know, father has, you know, some success as a doctor and stuff. But Pelham is a West Point cadet who, if it had not been for the war, you know, probably would have had a sort of, you know, quiet, unrecognized career in the U.S. military, maybe going out to the frontier. But he is this guy who, on one level, is born at exactly the right time because he has this preternatural understanding of artillery tactics, and he is brave and dashing, but at the same time, his men are exceptionally well drilled. They know exactly what to do at every given instant. And so he's this, you know, kind of ideal soldier who, you know, becomes, you know, in the Confederacy, you know, quite, you know, famous and revered, but only for a very short time. His greatest moment is at Fredericksburg. He holds off the advance of a third of the Union Army for more than an hour, or approximately an hour at least, with just one cannon. You know, Robert E. Lee, you know, says it's great to see such, you know, such courage in one so young. Jackson says, if I had a Pelham on both flanks, I could lick the world. You know, all of these incredible, you know, outpourings of praise for him. But then, in really his next battle after that, he runs out of luck and is killed. And you know, he's somebody who I think deserves to be known a little bit more. And one of the reasons for that is I think that one of the repeat tragedies in world history is the story of the talented, charismatic, upright person who finds himself on defending a tragically misbegotten cause. So he's this admirable person fighting in defense of values that we now find it impossible to admire. So you know, even within his persona and within his, you know, situation in the war, you know, I found this really kind of a cool and exciting literary tension that I could exploit for the interest of the reader.
Yeah, I think he was, the gallantry of the guy, as you said. Yeah. I mean, no fear. I think at the time was an inspiration. In fact, you mentioned that in the book many times through a number of passages, how he inspired men to, you know, dig deep down and find, you know, whatever ounce of energy, whatever for the cause. And, you know, very few throughout history, very few people are able to accomplish that. I want to take a quick pause to remind folks you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and educator John Madison. His new book, A Worse Place Than Hell, highlights individuals that for some are household names, but for the most part would have remained in obscurity had it not been for the Civil War and the Battle of Fredericksburg. And John, the one that stuck out for me, and I kind of saving him for last, because I'm feeling the guy's frustration, and that is Arthur Fuller, the Reverend Arthur Fuller. In one context, he's very sentimental, writing back to his wife, longing for that pre-war life, the simplicity and, you know, the normalcy of it all. But then he has this tremendous devotion, this need to remain with his men. Whether he's involved directly with a weapon in his hand fighting, or just there to comfort them, and more often than not, because of his role as a reverend, did just that. And I think, and you mentioned in the book how many soldiers, both those wounded, those who were not wounded, those who were dying, found comfort in just having him by their side. But I get the sense that there was a dichotomy in this man. In other words, he was pulled in many different directions and an inner conflict. Am I exaggerating here?
No, I think you've got it pretty well understood. To give a little bit of background, Arthur Fuller is the younger brother of Margaret Fuller, who also is not as well known of a household name now as perhaps she should be. She was an essential early feminist in America. She writes a book called Woman in the 19th Century, which is really the first really thought out elaborate call for legal and social equality for women. And Arthur's father is also a prominent man who serves four terms in Congress, is a good friend of John Quincy Adams. And then there's Arthur. And Arthur is a dreamer. He's a shy man. He's someone who's felt tragedy early in his life. When he's 10 years old, he has an accident where he loses an eye. After which, his parents respond in different ways. His father tries to toughen him up to compensate for the loss, and his mother treats him gently and coddles him, and so forth. He's getting these mixed messages about who he is and who he's supposed to be. He becomes a Unitarian minister, and he's a pretty respectable minister, but being a man with only one eye, being someone who has been coddled and placed in passive situations for a lot of his life, he hasn't yet proven to himself that he is a person of courage, that he's a person of action. And so he's very devoted to abolitionism. He's deeply, almost religiously committed to preserving the Union. But at the same time, he has this personal need to represent and demonstrate and show himself as I almost hate to use the phrase, but as a real man. And this eludes him even after he's been in the army for a while. He's sickly. He gets sent home with malaria. He wills himself out of his sickbed to go back and join the troops. They try to send him back because he's really not well. And then, I don't know if we should do the spoiler or not, but he has this amazing moment at Fredericksburg where he finally vindicates himself in the way that I think he always wanted to be, but at a catastrophic personal cost.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But as you said, that what inspired me so much, or why this gentleman jumps out at you when you read the book, it's like you said, he got mixed messages growing up, which even today could really mess up a kid. But more importantly, he just kept at it. He just kept soul searching and in other words, he did the right thing, at least in his mind and in his heart. It wasn't a matter of vindictiveness or anything like that. He just felt that he found his purpose, I guess, is what it really comes down to. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that's right. He finds his purpose, and as I suggested, he finds it at a tremendous personal cost. And one of the points that I really wanted to make clear in the book is the extraordinary peril that all five of these people were placing themselves in, because the hospitals were unsanitary, they were unsafe. Both Olcott and Whitman, who volunteer in nursing capacities, end up having lifelong health problems because of it. And of course, the actual scene of battle is this situation where weapons have become much more accurate, but the tactics are still sort of march in a straight line and so forth. And I have a friend who refers to a Civil War charge as being like it's like you're on the conveyor belt to the wood chipper. the chances of your absolutely being blown apart are frighteningly high.
Right.
And so this is it's a book, Al, that for me was an exploration of courage. You know, moral courage, physical courage, the courage to love and to share and to stand for, whatever principle it was that these individuals held sacred.
And you know, John, I think, and I'm not just saying that, I think you accomplished the mission accomplished, because that's the feeling I got. As I said, I'm a lover of history and have multitudes of books on Civil War, but it's always about a general, a particular battle. You get the maps and the whole, and everything else. And I'm not, there's mention of a number of skirmishes, from north to south, in your book, but more than anything else, it's about human beings rising to the occasion and the turmoil. Mm-hmm. And just to back up a little bit, in John's book, and John, you obviously feel the same way, because you put it between the pages of the book, and you talk about, we think about war today, and we think, well, you got those paved highways and you got pathways, and it was nothing like that. Some of the mention of foot thick mud, no shoes for weeks on end, marching 20 or 30 miles, no food, other times bitter cold with snow, with nothing more than maybe their musket or another human being side by side to keep you warm. I'm thinking, The human suffering of that period in American history, I don't think anybody can even fully grasp. So you bring to light so many things, but go ahead. I know you wanted to say something.
I agree with everything that you said, Alan. I'm glad that, that kind of message of the book does show through. Because another thing that I really wanted to do was to have this kind of almost moral chiaroscuro, to take a term from visual art, to have this dark background of suffering, but against which individual courage and commitment can shine forth in this really brilliant way. And when I say brilliant, I'm not talking about my writing. I'm talking about the people I write about.
Right.
And that's something that you learn as a biographer, that the reason that you're doing it is to, to pay tribute, to put other people center stage. I'm never going to be writing about somebody I don't like or someone I don't, somehow admire. Because it takes 5 years to write one of these books.
Right.
You don't want to spend all that time with someone you don't care for. Through the process of biography and through the process of the kind of history that I've done in this book, you do get to know these people sometimes in a way even more intimate than how you know your own family. Because I don't read my daughter's letters, there's this intimacy that grows up between the author and subject that for me just keeps bringing me back into it. I keep wanting to, to tell more and more stories.
And to someone who's, a reader like myself, finding one or two of these people, of the five, and of course there's mention of other people, but the focus on these particular individuals, but, the Pelham and Fuller for me, because of the inner conflict, it resonates, and I think anybody that reads the book would get the same sense. And even today, we fast forward. I was thinking after finishing the book, I'm thinking, today we have sports is such a big thing all over the world, and instantaneously, a high school, superstar in sports can become a national, hero to young people. And I'm thinking, these are real heroes. These are people that didn't have that kind of notoriety. There were no sports teams at the time. Nobody put them on the front pages of newspapers. They weren't interviewed by NECN or any of the major networks. And yet they made an impact on other people's lives. Just in the final few moments that we have, is that how you came away after finishing the book?
I think that's another really excellent point that you've made, that this is a story that takes place before the age of celebrity in America. And I think what you're talking about is that there's a kind of authenticity in what these people are doing, that it's not just for show. It's not just to be on the cover of the tabloid. It's not, to get people to buy tickets to your movie or to purchase your memoir or anything like that. It's absolutely real. And, you know, another thing about the book that I wanted to mention just for a second is that this is a book that over and over again reaffirms the connections of family, right? Because, you know, Holmes gets wounded. What happens? His father, you know, comes to try to find and save him. When Louisa May Alcott falls ill in the hospital and is possibly expected to die, who's there? Her father. He gets on the first train once again. You know, and Whitman has a brother who's wounded at Fredericksburg. And it's because of that brother that Whitman, you know, goes to the battlefield and gets involved in the war and decides that he'll be a nurse for the rest of the conflict. You know, these are all stories about kinship. They're stories about, you know, and often about relatives who don't really understand each other, right? Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. and Jr. fight constantly. Yeah, Bronson and Louisa May Alcott are completely different people.
Right.
The two Whitmans, you know, you'd never even pick them out as brothers in the same family. And yet in each of these instances, there is this fundamental love and commitment to kinship that for me is also inspiring.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm listening to you, I'm thinking exactly. And another footnote, and I didn't realize this, John, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Walt Whitman, perhaps not openly gay, but what was gay, right?
Yeah, there's really very little question of that at this point. You know, it's often very difficult to go back into time and to read the kind of, you know, social cues and codes and so on and so forth. But we absolutely know for a fact that that toward the end of the war, Whitman very much falls in love with a young veteran of Irish extraction, mm-hmm, named Peter Doyle. And they're a couple for several years. And you know, Whitman tries very, very hard to mask his sexuality in his poetry and in his other writings. But truth will out, and the truth about Whitman is that he was attracted to men.
Yeah.
And remains, I think, you know, kind of an icon as one of the first identifiably gay Americans. You know, whom you can look back on now and say, ah, wow, this, you know, this didn't just happen after the Stonewall riots. This has been a part of American life and a part of human life for as far as we can go back.
Exactly. And again, the inner struggle, you know, it's who he was deep inside.
Yeah.
But as you said, in some ways he tried to mask it through his writing and whatnot. So once again, you know, the inner conflict that each one of these five people endured during one of the most tumultuous times in U.S. history. John, the book, A Worse Place Than Hell, I mean, I can't think of a better title as well. I think that was very apropos because it really, anybody that studies anything about the Civil War, this was a bloody conflict. This was fought in such atrocious places and the hardship that so many people, I don't think anybody can really ever understand. It's not like today with the social media where this stuff would be in black, where this would be right in front of you in broad color and very detailed. There wasn't any of that. But obviously, the book is a great read. If people want to get more information or reach out to you directly, how might they do that?
Oh, my goodness. If you want information directly, probably the easiest way is to go through W.W. Norton.
Yeah.
And my publicist there, whose name is Erica Sineski Lovett. But if you direct the inquiries to www.norton.com, their communications websites or whatever,
right,
you can probably find me.
Yeah. And again, the book is A Worse Place Than Hell, The Battle of Fredericksburg, and the battle that changed the nation and the people that were changed by the episodes. And John so clearly brings them to life in a way. You have to read the book to really understand that. As I said, it certainly resonated with me, as I'm sure it does with many people. Whether you're a major history buff or not, this was American history And I think there's the other thing, John, real quickly, is I think there's a little bit of everybody in each one of these people, the inner conflicts, as you said, the family turmoils, things that we're all dealing with to this very day. As much as we think, well, that was, over 100 years ago, things have changed. Yes, they have. But, in other ways, they have not changed so much. So a great read. It really is. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the WISN studios. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, author and educator John Madison, the book A Worse Place Than Hell. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona.